From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
So the issue, therefore, really is, why do religions matter so much to those that belong to them? Why do religious people perceive that they're more important things in life than living?
The result is a kind of indoctrination. The known world is entirely a secular world, and religion is exiled to the fringes, becoming a matter of faith at best and superstition at worst. There is no real marketplace of ideas in public education, at least when it comes to religion. Modern secular science has a stranglehold on education. Fairness and open-mindedness seem to have lost standing as educational virtues.
Welcome to Soundings. Will religion destroy the world? That question is central to two discussions this week on Soundings. My guests are two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center, John Bowker of Cambridge University and Warren Nord of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with John Bowker. Following that, commentary by Warren Nord. John Bowker, you're a visitor at the National Humanities Center. You are the dean of Trinity College at Cambridge University. Why are the churches destroying the world? That seems to me an enormous contradiction or paradox. Help me with it.
Well, it's not just the churches. It's religions in general which are certainly going to destroy the world. And that's not just a trailer, you know, like a headline, like I remember Beachcomber once invented a headline, 60 horses wedged in a chimney. I'm not just trying to catch attention. I really do think that the first nuclear, second atomic war is more likely to break out in these areas where there are conflicts that at the moment seem to us insoluble, which have religious components in them.
So, for example?
The Middle East immediately comes to mind with several different types of conflicts. Northern Ireland, Sri Lanka, Sikhs in Amritsar, South Africa, which was originally had a religious component in apartheid, the Philippines. Actually, even the most dangerous divide of all between Russia and America has deep religious components when you think of the Marxist-Leninist view that religion must wither away if there is to be the dictatorship of the proletariat. And if you look at some of the kinds of statements that are sometimes made in America, for example, President Reagan's speech in Orlando, which seems to be coding Russia in terms of the Antichrist.
The evil empire. Yeah.
So if you think of how many of those really intransigent disputes, I mean, for example, this in Sri Lanka, we don't here have a 30 years war of religion, we have a 2030 years war of religion. One of the oldest historical chronicles in Sri Lanka is a story of Buddhists supporting the local king in going and fighting the Damalas. So it isn't always violent, but this tension has been there right through almost the history of Sri Lanka.
John Bowker, let me remind you that you are speaking principally to an American audience. Whether we are justified or not, we speak from our, what, sort of triumphalist standpoint. We live in a society where church and state are separate. We don't have to worry about this. The Irish can fight their wars, the Tamils, the Sikhs, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims in the Middle East. That's their problem. How in the heck are we going to get involved in a nuclear war?
Well, there are two points there. The first is you are involved in all these, most of these conflicts because America is involved all around the free world. Mm-hmm. Consequently, it matters a great deal that American politicians and military should actually understand the dynamics of religious systems.
What are you suggesting, that we all become historians of some sort? When you say understand, what do you mean?
I think you should become systems analysts and try to understand why do religious systems function with such a dangerous sort of dynamic within them. I sometimes think actually everybody in the world should have a vote for the American president. I mean, you are involved at one remove maybe in so many of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Emperor of the universe.
Well, and not tremendously good at understanding them, partly for the reason you've just given, because of the separation of church and state, which I think was a very wise move with so many refugees from religious persecution. But it means that America can't altogether understand religions, can't altogether take them seriously, because it's an option. It's a private thing that people do if they want to do it.
Right.
Okay. Now, Russia can't understand religions either, because they're not supposed to be there. Right. They're a temporary stage of compensation in the move towards the dictatorship of the proletariat. So the issue, therefore, really is, why do religions matter so much to those that belong to them? Why do religious people perceive that they're more important things in life than living?
Well, because they have faith. They are believers. They have committed themselves to a particular, transcendental or ideological or social agenda, and that helps to dictate their lives. Are you going to criticize that? I mean, doesn't that give us a sense of order and harmony in our lives?
Just having faith doesn't make you destroy the world.
Uh-huh.
Why can't we coexist, as to a great extent America shows that one can,
with different
belief systems?
One of the problems is that so many of these faiths, regardless of how we want to describe them from the inside or the outside, is that they tend to be rather absolute in their view of things, of life, of the way life should be lived. And when my neighbor across the green line says, no, I'm not going to do it that way, then we blow him away.
But it's much more profound than that. You can have absolute and strong views and not want to blow all your neighbors away.
Tell me about that.
The problem of religions and why they are so dangerous is because they are so important. Virtually all the really profound achievements and enduring achievements have religious resources and roots also. Art, architecture, drama, dance, even agriculture, even the natural sciences originally came out of religious resources.
Uh-huh.
So the reason why religions are such bad news for people is because they're such good news. And why that is
so. You mean in the sense of creating an illusion that we live by, that we're not really understanding what we mean when we say religion?
It's not an illusion. Religions are the resource, they're the context from which all the most profound and enduring human achievements have originally come. Mm-hmm. I realize now that religion has become decoupled, shall we say, from the natural science, and it's perfectly possible to be secular and non-religious, but this is a fairly recent phenomenon. The reason why religions matter so much is because they are the earliest primordial cultural achievement that humans made for the defense of gene replication and the nurture of children.
Mm-hmm.
That's much more profound than any later surface beliefs about the nature of God, life after death, and so on. Indeed, all religions, East and West, that have endured began without any belief there would be a life with God after death.
Hmm.
They are therefore a tremendous human achievement of what this architecture of atoms and molecules is really capable of experiencing and knowing and achieving.
But there are walls around these molecules and these cells. I mean, we may move incrementally within them, but then we bump up to something that is really different, that we don't like and we don't want to accommodate.
That's the correct model, and that's what I meant by saying one needs to be a better systems analyst to understand this. What we have here are the earliest achievements for the really fundamental things of gene replication, nurture of children. If that weren't protected by human systems, and culture is the sort of second skin, we have the first skin to defend the genes, and culture's the second skin.
Mm-hmm.
If we didn't have good second skins, then you and I wouldn't be here today. So religions are systems for the protection and process of the information that humans have discerned as, they may not have done it consciously or verbally, but they in practice have found out this is the way in which both the replication, they wouldn't talk in these words, I'm going to have grandchildren.
Right.
That's how they perceive it. This is how there is a probability that I will have children and they will survive and they will be happy. And these are the resources they need for that to occur. Now, some of these are very fundamental, family and food. And religions always lock on to sex and food, as you know, all religious systems. Mm-hmm. But religions also are the context in which much more extensive discoveries are made, until eventually the discovery that there is a possibility of relationship, interaction, with one who is appropriately described as then dot dot dot. You see, it might be Vishnu, Brahma, Allah.
Well, God. we can give it a very large word, the other, something that is not us, something that is other than us.
Correct. And all our pictures and languages about that will be approximate, provisional, corrigible, and mainly wrong, mm-hmm. just as they are about the universe. You see, anything we say about the universe is mainly wrong. But wrong about what, we ask in the case of the universe. And in this way, we get provisional reliabilities, very extensive reliabilities in the natural sciences. Now, in religions and theology, a comparable reliability has been built up through time, and actually through a much longer period of time, in which the pictures of God, the pictures of the other, are constantly being transformed. There was a time when we all thought God sat on a throne with a long white beard or some triviality right. like that. Now, it's just because the picture has to be discarded, it doesn't follow that because it's wrong, that it wasn't wrong about something. So as with the universe, so with the other, which is described as God, the pictures are constantly being winnowed and changed. But they can only be changed because there is great reliability in terms of attending to the possibility of God in the appropriate ways, like mm-hmm. prayer, meditation, contemplation, and so on.
John Bowker, tell me, the starting point for our conversation was this statement that you've put on the table, that the churches are destroying the world. What are they supposed to do not to destroy the world? Are you suggesting structural changes? Are you talking about ecumenical movements? What specifically have you got in mind?
It is an incorporation of self-perception. The basic point is that where you have systems, and religions are strong systems, they're protecting information that's much more important than splitting atoms.
Yeah. Languages, codes, the things that bind us together.
Well, also literal kinds of systems of hierarchies of control.
Uh-huh.
Vatican Catholicism would be a very good example of a strong system where there is... was stronger than it is now when there was the confessional Catholic education. But even now there will be letters or declarations on, for example, embryo research,
right.
Where the church instructs people so that their consciences are informed. That would be an example of a strong system. Now, where you have boundaries, which are sometimes literal but often metaphorical, an example of a literal boundary would be that an Orthodox Hindu, until the turn of this century, was never allowed to leave the boundaries of India.
Right.
He would betray his Orthodoxy if he did. Where you have systems and boundaries, there you have border incidents. That is predictable. People are not going to give up the things that matter more to them than anything else.
And the analogy here is to the political world, the geopolitical world.
That's absolutely correct. But in the religious case, there's more on the table.
Yeah.
It's not just a question of the integrity of the borders of the land or who's going to get access to the headwaters of the River Jordan or something like that. That's involved in it. Religions never cause these things alone. They're a contribution and a reinforcement. But the religious issues are even more profound because they have the information that they're protecting. Not only tells you how to live an appropriate life here and now, but they point to goals which lie beyond the boundaries of this life and beyond death. So the information is too important to abandon.
Mm-hmm. I get a sense of the importance, you know, as it were, of the stakes that you're talking about here, the relationship between nothing less important or grandiose than the survival of the world and institutional religion. Let's come back to your original point, John Bowker, and let me put it to you again in the form of a question. Will the churches destroy the world?
I don't know, it's the churches. I'm talking more about religions than churches. The churches might be involved in this, but I'm talking about the areas where there are religious ideations and commitments and religious systems.
You asking me to water down my beliefs so that I can get along with somebody?
Absolutely not. Uh-huh. I think we've got to move in the opposite direction.
To expand them.
Much interreligious discussion tries to get agreement. It says, are we against sin? And the answer is yes. And the problem of that way of approach to these political religious disputes is it's too easy to get agreement on generalizations. We've got to begin the other way around. We have got to begin by really sorting out what are the differences and why do they matter so much.
Yeah.
And therefore, I believe the only way forward in negotiation in such areas as the West Bank or Sri Lanka or Northern Ireland is that you start by asking the participants in these systems on each side, or they ask each other, what do you perceive as necessary for your grandchildren to grow up as a good Catholic, a good Muslim, good Hindu, whatever? When you ask that question, you get a pile as high as Mount Everest.
Mm-hmm.
You get absolutely everything. And then, and I don't want this to be misunderstood or to sound flippant, this is very serious. You then say, but what did the Jews need in the concentration camps of Europe in order to remain Jewish? And the answer is virtually nothing. Now, I'm not saying we should therefore go to nothing or everything. The mm-hmm. art of negotiation in these disputes is to find that middle ground
right.
where the perception of the participant says, yes, well, I don't need absolutely everything. This is sufficient for me to have a good hope that my children, my grandchildren, will have the free opportunity to grow up.
Do you think the Ayatollah would buy an argument like this, John Bowker? Would you be just sort of whistling in the wind here talking to somebody who's been described fanatic, absolutist, tyrannical?
That sort of language indicates why we need to take religions more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that language. I've heard it in America many times. I remember after the Iran hostage, a very prominent American came up to me and took me by the elbow, and he said, well, now you can see we're beginning to take Muslim fanaticism seriously.
Mm.
Now, once you use a word like that, you already show that you don't really understand. I think one of the reasons, and I'll come back to your question in a moment, one of the reasons why we drift from one disaster and one ineptitude to another, particularly in American foreign policy, is because far too few politicians, far too few industrialists have ever read religious studies at a university. It's not that education will change the thing just like that. You know the saying that once you've educated the devil, all you have at the end is a clever devil. It's that education will give you perception and uh-huh. insight. It will modify the style. Now, to come back to the Ayatollah, all religions have resources within them which are the voice of conciliation, of peace, of living with your neighbor, even if your neighbor has a different religion.
So you're telling me that we're beginning to find some favorable white spots on what appears to be a very black, dark picture.
Yes, I think it's more that there's a very big white canvas and there are some very black holes within
uh-huh,
it.
Uh-huh.
I think that the conflict scenario, although it's recurrent, is very avoidable, provided you have sufficient knowledge and insight and can share it in the situation, of what are the conditions of continuity.
You remind me of a wonderful line from Emerson, tell me your sect and I will anticipate your argument. Maybe that's a 19th century way of saying let's understand one another.
It's more than just understanding one another. That would be too facile.
Mm-hmm.
It's we've got to understand that there are resources in every religious tradition which advocate coexistence and living with each other, but not in a stupid, trivial way.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be by understanding the differences. Now, Jews in the Mediterranean world were really a great deal safer. They were a great deal safer than Jews in Europe were when they were under Muslim rule. It isn't automatic there has to be the conflict. We have to find the resources within each religion which says we can live with each other on these terms.
And you're assuming that those resources are there, are you not?
I'm not only assuming, I'm stating. As a matter of fact, it is a matter of fact, the resources are there, and we need to find the means of mobilizing them. They cannot be mobilized when the boundary conflict situation is simply being handled in a rather naive political, geographic, economic sort of way. Those are important factors, but the religious component is the key to it, because it's the religious ideation which is the world inside a believer's head.
We want to move from the local to the universal without what? Losing our sense of the local at the same time.
Absolutely correct. We must retain the sense of the differentiation of religions. Always start by understanding the differences and why they matter. On the basis of that, then find the means in these systems that they all have for living coherently and supportively of each other. There is the means always there. The problem is, at the moment, in most political negotiations and discussions, nobody will take the religious dimension seriously. They will talk about it as fanaticism, all those other sorts of words. We have to see that religious beliefs and practices matter to people more than anything else, not for fanatical reasons, not for childish infancy of the human race reasons, but because they are the source of all that is worthwhile in human life, all that is inspiring and enduring. And at the simplest level, they are the context in which many people say, this is my life, this is good, this is how I want to live. This is why there are 40,000 women demonstrating in Turkey saying, we want to go back under the veil. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't say that a woman in New York is ever going to agree with them. I'm saying, try to understand why they want to be on the streets demonstrating for that. What do they perceive about their children, about their style of life, that makes them say, this is good, this is for me? If we understand on that level, then we can see how we can live together, with some wearing veils and some not. I don't say that I'm going to wear a veil, and I'm sure you're not either.
John Bowker is Dean and Fellow of Trinity College at Cambridge University. He was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center and at North Carolina State University, where he delivered a lecture entitled, Will Religion Destroy the World? The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with commentary about religion in the modern world. Here is Warren Nord, director of the program in the humanities and human values at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
Last spring, a federal district court judge in Alabama fired the latest salvo in the continuing war of the religious right against secular humanism. Judge Hand ruled that 44 textbooks approved for use in the Alabama public schools unconstitutionally promoted the religion of secular humanism and had to be withdrawn from use. The immediate response from virtually everyone to Hand's left was that his decision was poorly argued, if not outrageous, and that it would surely be overturned by higher courts. In a review of the decision, Harvard constitutional law scholar Alan Dershowitz called Hand the Ayatollah Khomeini of the federal judiciary and claimed that his decisions deserve no respect. They are simple bigotry under color of law. It may very well be that Hand's decision is no jewel of legal reasoning. Nonetheless, I believe that there is something to be said for Hand's position, though it is not quite what he says. Judge Hand is primarily concerned with history and home economics textbooks. He believes that most history books commit a sin of omission. They discriminate against the very concept of religion by omitting virtually all references to religion in American history. In effect, they promote secular humanism by denying students knowledge of our religious heritage. Hand has some support on this count. Within the last year, there have been three major studies of the place of religion in history textbooks, including one by the liberal People for the American Way, and all concluded that religion was absent from the books to the point where they seriously distorted American history. In fact, religion virtually disappears from the last several hundred years of our history in all of the texts. The average book gives 0.3% of its pages to matters have anything at all to do with religion after 1800, less space than they typically give to cowboys and cattle drives. According to Hand, the home economics books teach moral relativism and humanistic psychology, and he attached 30 pages of quotations from them to his opinion to prove his point. For example, one of these books claims that your conscience is simply you talking to yourself. Another declares that values are personal and subjective. They vary from person to person. Many of them declare self-actualization to be the highest level of human need and ignore spiritual needs completely. One claims that morals are rules made by people. According to Han, such claims naturally lead a student to conclude that he must determine right and wrong based only on his own experience, and that moral choices are just a matter of preference. These books claim that morality originates in personal needs and choices, not in the will of God. Han tries to make his case by arguing that, in effect, the books teach a religion, the religion of secular humanism, and as such they violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. They establish secular humanism as the religion of public education. I'm inclined to think that Han doesn't make his case, though I'm also inclined to think that it is not so wild an argument as many of his critics make it out to be. What I do want to suggest now is that whether or not the textbooks teach secular humanism, whatever that is, and whether or not secular humanism is a religion, whatever that is, these textbooks do initiate students into an entirely secular world, understood in entirely secular terms, and this does intellectually undercut much, if not all, traditional religion. In the past few months, I've reviewed some 28 history, home economics, and biology books approved for use in North Carolina. None of them suggest to students that there might be any other way of thinking about the world than the view provided in that textbook. They are all utterly parochial. They all see the world from the vantage point of a particular philosophical niche, that of modern secular science. The understanding students acquire from biology books of how the world and how living things were created is entirely secular. The understanding they acquire from history books of the shape of human history is entirely secular. The understanding they acquire from home economics books of morality and human nature and decision-making is entirely secular. The result is a kind of indoctrination. The known world is entirely a secular world, and religion is exiled to the fringes, becoming a matter of faith at best and superstition at worst. There is no real marketplace of ideas in public education, at least when it comes to religion. Modern secular science has a stranglehold on education. Fairness and open-mindedness seem to have lost standing as educational virtues. As a liberal, I find this situation morally and intellectually untenable. Religion ought to have its day in court. There is some small irony in the fact that we give people accused of the most heinous crimes free defense attorneys, a jury of their peers, and as many days in court as they need, but we will not give religion, which still I think has some claim to truth, any place in textbooks or public education.
Warren Nord is director of the program in the Humanities and Human Values at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His commentary on religion and education was recently published in the Washington Post. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Religion and the Modern World, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations about black literature and history. My guests will be the novelist George Lamming and Darlene Clark Hine, an historian from Michigan State University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Will religion destroy the world? That's the topic this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center. John Bowker, Dean and Fellow of Trinity College at Cambridge University, and Warren Nord of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill provide some answers and insights. Religion and the Modern World, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.